Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, I'm Nicola. Welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Steph, Teresa, Linda and Heather.
Hello!
Hi.
This week on Write Club, Linda will be reading to us from a work in progress, after which we'll offer her our comments, just as we do in our Write Club meetings. Heather's going to amuse or entertain us, I'm not sure which, and then we're going to talk about the crime writer's journey. And we have an interview with Noelle Holton. Then we're going to hear what Teresa and Bambi Lynn are reading at the moment on their bedside tables. But first, Steph is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Right, are you ready?
Yes,
ready. Pencil sharpened.
Okay, after my win last week.
Okay, clue number one. This book, first published in 2013, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2014, among many other awards. It's named after an animal.
Mm.
Or the title is the name of an animal.
Mm. Like the species of animal or like a name like Ben the Bear?
Okay. Number two. It's the third novel of a female author who hails from Mississippi. She won the 2013 W.H. Smith Literary Award for her second novel, The Little Friend,
yeah,
which was translated into 30 languages.
Yeah.
Okay, and now the story. I'm sure you'll get it from this clue three. The narrator, Theo, miraculously survived a bomb blast which killed his mother when he was a young teenager.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. Mississippi, I should know.
You should
well,
know.
Well, the book is nothing to do with Mississippi. It starts in New York and part of it's in Las Vegas, I think.
But
it's
and also in Holland, yeah.
Yes, of course, they go to Holland. It's The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt.
Oh.
Absolutely brilliant. Oh. And the description of the explosion
is amazing.
Is a masterclass in writing.
Really?
And it's early in the book. So,
oh,
you know.
Check it out then. What's it called?
The Goldfinch. I think I have a copy. I'm building up your Sundoku nicely, aren't I?
My real one, yes.
Yeah.
Mm. No, I think it's a must-read. It's mesmerising language.
It's a wonderful book.
Oh, right. And it starts off with Theo Decker, who's 13 years old or 14 years old at the time, and his mother is killed in this bomb blast, and the description of him walking out of the bomb blast, all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He's taken in because his father has already abandoned them. So he's taken in by the family of a wealthy friend. So it goes on from there. He gets drawn into the underworld
of art. No spoilers.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a brilliant book.
It's a very good book. I would recommend it.
Okay.
And I think Donna Tartt, you know, she's been acclaimed for both her first two novels, The Secret History and The Little Friend.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then she won the Pulitzer Prize for The Goldfinch. But that book also won the National Book Critics Circles Award, an Australian Book Industry Award. She was nominated for a Women's Prize in Fiction. She's been nominated for the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Fiction. So, you know,
internationally acclaimed.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think the film is out in August this
year. I think
it's
coming out.
The film's coming out later this year.
Ah, so great. Read the book before the film comes out.
Absolutely.
Okay, so thank you very much, Steph. Now, as I promised, we're going to listen to Linda read from her current work in progress.
Yes, we're going to go back to see what Mary Magdalene and Eli are up to. And I guess some weeks ago, I read about their experience when Eli was singing on the square and creating quite a stir, especially with Melba, the waitress in the drugstore across the street, who thought he was the handsomest thing, and he could be a singer in Nashville. He's good. And she's all fired up. So now he's finished singing. He has joined Mary Magdalene in the drugstore. So the bell over the door rang. A big man wearing a T-shirt under his denim overalls came in. "Hey, preacher." He was looking at Eli and Mary Magdalene. "Is that your jeep and trailer house across from Roberts?" Eli turned. "Yeah, it is. Why are you asking?" "Name's Emmett. I go by Robert's on my way home, and I saw, well, the trailer door is wide open, and it's got a flat tire. If I was you, I'd go see about it. Eli, Mary Magdalene's voice was scolding. I locked that door before we left, but then you went back and got your guitar. Did you leave it unlocked? She was put out. I'll go see about it. A flat tire? Why would that tire be flat? Brody said them tires was nearly new when we bought that trailer. Eli got up to leave. I'll go with you, said Emmett. Melba stood holding two hamburger plates with all the trimmings, one in each hand. She was as deflated as the tire on the trailer. Both Eli's and Mary Magdalene's hamburgers were cold by the time he and Emmett got back. He didn't look at it as he sat down in the booth. Somebody's been in there, he said to Mary Magdalene. I can't tell if they robbed anything because I don't even know what all was in there. I know the sugar bowl was broken the floor, and whoever it was had pulled out all the drawers, pulled the mattress off in the bed, just everything is turned upside down. I guess they was looking for money. They even ripped your little yellow duck open and pulled out the stuffing. Mary Magdalene was like a pressure cooker building up too much steam. At the mention of the little fuzzy yellow duck, the safety plug blew. That is my duck. There ain't no need for anybody to go and mess with her. That's my duck. I want my duck and it not all ripped up to pieces. She was pitching a hissy fit to be proud of. Get a hold of yourself, Maggie. What's so important about that duck when we got a flat tire and a robbed house? Settle down. As an afterthought, he said, I didn't even know that duck was a girl. Melba came running back to the booth. Everything all right here? What can I do for you? You want a refill on that coffee? You all right, hon? That last part of the question was addressed to Mary Magdalene. Yeah, I'd like some more coffee. You want something else, Maggie? Why, you ain't even touched your hamburgers. Eli's meal drooped before him on the table. Mary Magdalene had picked at a few of the French fries, but she was too upset to eat. Melba picked up the plates. Let me take these back and make you some fresh ones, darling. Looks like you're not going anywhere tonight, said Emmett. You can see about getting another tire over at Cletus' garage tomorrow, but he might have to order it. Looked like to me it was an odd size. You and Scott any place to stay for a couple of days? There's a rooming house over on Sycamore, but I don't know how much they charge. They can stay with me, Melba was. Melba was a bugler sounding the charge.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Good old Melba.
Absolutely great.
Yeah.
I just had a thought. Melba didn't slash the tyre, did she?
Sabotage.
Just to get her hands on you. I know she did. Of course she did.
I love the reference back to the little yellow duck and it, him saying, I didn't even know that duck was going off.
It's so funny.
That was just such a classic line that really made me laugh out loud. A couple of tiny points, really, Linda. Uh-huh. Melba stood holding two hamburger plates with all the trimmings, one in each hand. She was deflated as the tyre on the trailer. Mm-hmm. That is a slight point of view shift and perhaps it's somebody else needs to observe.
Looking as deflated.
Oh, she looked as deflated.
Okay, thank you.
Just a minor
thing. But
it's
funny.
It is funny, yeah.
And I never knew you spelled tyre like that.
You do in America, don't you? Because they don't spell things right.
I'm sorry. For those of you listening, I spell tyre the proper way. It's spelled T-I-R-E.
That is as in to be tired.
Yeah.
No, you tired. I tire easily.
Well, what do you spell?
T-Y-R-E for a thing that goes on a...
How snooty can we get?
Oh, we can do better than that.
Okay.
Ladies.
And the other, again, another tiny thing, when it says, as an afterthought, he added... I didn't even know that duck was a girl. She's a classic, brilliant line. I wondered if you could maybe show us it was an afterthought by having him walk towards the door and then stop with his hand on the door.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that duck was a girl. You know, that would, rather than telling us it was an afterthought. But
or whatever he's doing there, put his paw down or whatever. Yeah.
Just, that's a minor thing, Linda, and it's really just looking for ways to beef it up and for something to say, really.
Yeah.
Can I ask, is this where the money's going? No, the money has gone earlier than that. Yeah. That's why he wants to preach on the square.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Why is she so... I mean, obviously it was a present from her mother, was it?
No,
was
it was
she won it. She won it at the fair.
He won it for her.
So why is she so obsessed about it?
Because she's a child and it's her toy. And
first time she's acted like a child in the whole book, isn't it?
Yeah,
but that was good.
Yeah.
She's very upset because they've been robbed and somebody tore up her duck. And,
And she, because she said to, because Eli said, well, why didn't you get the big teddy? She said, are you stupid? We haven't got room for the big teddy in the van, but, you know, the little duck.
Yeah. And this will always remind us that we paid $3 for a $1 duck.
Yeah, I just had, you know, I mean, I think it's absolutely great, but even more so when you read it out, I thought this, but I'd already made note. So, Eli, Mary Magdalene's voice was scolding. I locked that door before we left, but then you went back and got your guitar. Did you leave it unlocked? You don't need to say she was put out. Okay. And even saying she was put out is a bit less than she actually is. Okay. But I just think we know she's mad as hell, so you don't have to tell us it.
No, I don't think you need to tell us her voice was scolding, but, you know, I think the dialogue speaks for itself, but that's up to you.
And then... And I didn't notice it when I read through, but as you were reading it, I thought there was another one like that about when the duck was ripped up and I want it not ripped all to pieces.
Yeah.
She was pitching a hissy fit to be proud of, which is a great expression. Mm-hmm. But again, we see it. Mm-hmm. We don't need you to tell us what we're looking at.
Yeah.
But that's
or you
just
could
my
have
thought.
Eli saying, boy, you're pitching a hissy fit.
Yeah, stop.
And then he could stop and go, I didn't even know that duck was a girl. Because I love that line.
But, you know, I think it's great. And that it was very, you know, difficult to find anything to critique. Just keep going.
Thank you.
She'll get to Little Rock eventually. And we're loving it.
Well, thank you. This is what I remember. I told you that I went to sleep thinking about what could happen next.
Yeah.
This is what I wrote when I got up in the morning and I just sat down and wrote.
It's great, isn't it, when that happens?
That's wonderful. Before it, but
that's fabulous.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for your comments and your helpful criticism.
Heather, are you ready to enlighten or amuse us?
I am, certainly. I heard the phrase laughing your head off and I wondered what on earth it meant. So I got my friend Google and had a look, and I found on the National Trusts for Scotland website a piece about Culloden. And it says, it was this month in 1747, the 9th of April to be exact, that Simon Fraser, Lord Lovat, was executed on Tower Hill in London by John Thrift. Lovat was chief of Clan Fraser of Lovat, and by all accounts he was not a particularly nice man, with a violent streak and a cunning mind. During the 1745 uprising, he forced his son to fight with the Jacobites, while he himself professed his loyalty to King George II, claiming his son's actions were against his wishes. Following the Jacobites' defeat at Culloden, his deceit was soon found out by the government, and he was forced into hiding in the Highlands. He was eventually arrested on an island in Loch Morar and transported to London, where after a trial lasting 5 days, in which evidence was given against him by fellow Jacobite John Murray of Broughton, he was sentenced to beheading on the 19th of March 1747. Shortly before the execution, a scaffold for spectators viewing the beheading had collapsed and left 20 dead, much to his amusement. Apparently, Lovat was laughing at the spectacle as the executioner's axe fell. So ended the life of Simon Fraser, and the phrase, laughing your head off, was born.
That is a
great story.
That is brilliant.
I didn't know any of that.
Yes, I didn't either.
Imagine a wily old thing, you know, having one faction of the family fighting for one side and one side.
Ah, that's more than wily. That's really naughty.
Machiavellian, something like that.
Brilliant,
Heather. Thank you very much. Now we've got an interview with crime writer Noel Holton, whose new book will be out at the end of May.
We're delighted to welcome Noel Holton, award-winning blogger at crimebookjunkie.co.uk, PR and social media manager for Bookouture, a leading digital publisher in the UK, and debut author of Dead Inside, first in an exciting new crime series,
which will be published on May 31st. Welcome, Noelle, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you both for having me.
So tell me, Noelle, did you always want to be a writer?
I think I would have to say yes. I've always dreamed of writing. You know, in high school, I went to high school in Canada, and I did a lot of English literature and creative writing courses. So I think I've always had this. And I used to write really kind of dark and dreary poetry in my teens. But then I sort of just stopped. I started reading more and focusing on my studies. I went to university and stuff. And then last year, the year before last, well, a couple of years ago, I started getting that kind of feeling again. I would love to write a book, but never thought I would ever be able to. And if I did, that it would just sit in a drawer. And I went to Crime and Publishment, a course run by Graham Smith. And I came away from that the Monday, and that was in March. By mid-May, I had finished the first draft of the book.
Whoa. Wow. Good God.
I don't like this woman much.
I'm not trying to brag or anything, but the course really kind of gave me that kickstart. I had the idea and the book in my head for, you know, years and years and years. And just going to something like that really gave me that kick up the butt to start writing, mm-hmm. put it all down in paper. So, and by the way, that was the first very, very rough draft. Months of edits followed before it was even submission ready. But yes.
That's brilliant.
That is amazing.
That is incredible. So what is it about crime that fascinates you?
Oh, gosh. I've been reading, well, I started out reading horror probably when I was about 11, much to my parents' dismay, and then went on to true crime. And then probably my late teens, I started reading crime fiction. And there's just something about it. I mean, the stories themselves just fascinated me, especially the true crime stories, because you really, I suppose for me, it was always wanting to figure out what made that person tick. Why did they do what they did? And of course, then my whole university career was on criminal justice and sociology and all that. And then I went into probation. So I've always had this kind of interest in crime and criminology forever. So I think for me, because it's what I know, that's what I enjoy writing.
Excellent. So where do you get your inspiration from?
Like I said, I was in probation for 18 years. So there's lots of interesting stories that I came across and people, obviously I'm not writing about them. It's not true crime. So they needn't be worried that they will never appear in my books, but it does give you a lot of ideas and, you know, even news stories, things you hear on the street. I mean, you'd be amazed at the things that people will talk about when they think no one's listening. And you kind of think, oh, well, what if this happened? That, you know, putting that interesting little twist on it. Mm-hmm. So I think I draw my inspiration from pretty much anything and everything around me.
You're just soaking it all up and storing it up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes.
Great.
So people need to be careful about conversations they're having when you're sitting behind them.
Absolutely they do.
I'm always impressed by the plots in crime books and the ideas that people come up with. It's amazing. Do you spend a lot of time plotting before you start writing?
I don't think I do, really. I mean, I have a general idea of where I want the story to go. And whether right or wrong, I always write the last two chapters of the book before anything. So I've just finished the draft of my second novel and I wrote the last two chapters first and then kind of wrote towards that. And same with this novel. I kind of had the focus of where I wanted to go. Didn't know how I was going to get there and fingers crossed I could get there. But you have that kind of, because I knew how I wanted it to end, I knew how I needed to manipulate the plot and get the characters where they needed to be. And I kind of, I'm not normal in the sense of my writing is just purely chaotic. I don't write in order. Nothing's chronological. Whatever's in my head goes down on the computer. And then I worry about changing it and swapping it around in the edits. So, right. Yes.
So writing the end first. Yeah, that's really interesting.
I've never heard of that before.
No, but, you know, there's a certain sense,
isn't there?
I can
see that. I can see the logic in it. Know where you're going and then you know where you're manipulating it, because sometimes you get towards the end of a draft and you think, oh,
I should have said this earlier on, because this is going to happen now, and you have to go back and kind of foreshadow the ending that you're doing. Yeah. So in terms of research, now you mentioned that your background is in law and sociology and crime and so on. So what kind of research do you have to do when you're writing over and above the stuff you know already?
I know a lot about probation, and my first book has a lot of probation in it. So I didn't have to do much research on that end. And I also worked in a police station in a multi-agency team. So I had some knowledge in terms of, you know, what the police do and some of their techniques. But for the nitty-gritty stuff, you kind of have to dig that little bit deeper. So, you know, I had to Google a few things. And I use, for a lot of the forensic science stuff, I use this book by Kate Bendelow, The Real CSI. Which is a brilliant book. And also I've used Silent Witness by Nigel McCreary. So those kind of things. And I have some kind of little books on police practice and procedure, because I think if you're going to write about this kind of thing and your protagonist, or there's a lot of police procedure in it, you really do have to get it right, because regardless of whether or not someone's been in or knows about the criminal justice system, someone who is an avid crime fiction reader will call you out on it.
Yeah.
They will say, that's not right. You know, and unfortunately, because of that, you know, you might get a few stars knocked off your reviews or criticized. So I do think it's important. There are some bits in my book, Dead Inside, where I've kind of stretched the truth a little bit, but I make it quite clear that I've done that. You know, in my little bit at the end, I say I am aware of that, but in order for the story to flow, I kind of had to speed things up or stretch things out. So, you know, I know forensics don't come back within a day, but for the story to move on, it had to.
Yeah. You can't have people sitting around for a week, you know, because that's no fun for the reader.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for writers in general, or more specifically for writers of crime fiction?
I would say for me, and this is what worked personally for me, I have to write every day. I always dedicate an hour, just an hour. So when people say, oh, I don't have time to do it, you know, that hour I could have been watching TV or doing something else. So I always spend an hour a day, and I type quite fast. So I usually can, you know, push out 1,000 words, and that's it. I don't then feel pressured or anything. So I would always say to someone, make the time and write every day, even if it's just a little bit. You know, you don't have to set a goal, but get your brain, you know, working in that kind of mode that this is what you need to focus on, and spend that time. And also for me, anything that's in my head, I get down on the page right away. So I'll worry about editing it at the end, you know, as long as I, you know, it's flowing and it's coming out of me, I need to get it out of my head, because, you know, if I say, oh, I'll come back to that later, and I haven't written it down or anything, it's gone. So I don't remember it. And also what we were talking about earlier, do your research, especially for crime fiction. If you're going to be specific about setting and places, and you're going to make it as realistic and as authentic as possible, make sure you've nailed your research, because people will pull you on it.
Yeah, don't underestimate the reader.
Absolutely.
So in terms of a crime novel, do you think that there are, I mean, obviously there has to be a crime.
Yeah.
That's something that you have to have in a crime novel that you don't necessarily have to have in other novels. But are there other elements, like, you know, do you have to have a love interest, or do you have to have a troubled home life for the detective or something? You know, what are the kind of elements that you like to put into a crime novel?
I think, you know, like you say, the obvious with the crime, you've got to have the problems of the crime and the solution. I think conflict is really good to have in a crime novel. You know, even if it's internal conflict within the character itself, some sort of conflict that kind of has people going, ooh, what's going to happen here? And I think having a good pace, you know, something that doesn't kind of drag in the middle, or you have your investigation in the beginning and then, you know, 30 chapters later, there's something. I think the pace has to be bang on for a crime novel. Romance, I'm not too bothered about. I don't mind books, crime books that have a bit of romance in it, as long as they don't kind of focus on that, because then I'm thinking I'm reading a romance novel. And I think it's lovely when, you know, a character gets together with someone else. But I don't want to read about that. As a crime reader, because I've been reading crime for years, I want to know, you know, that
that investigation. I want to know the crime, the motive. I think things like this are important. And I also, personally for me, I don't necessarily believe that the crime has to be wrapped up at the end. I know many readers will shoot me and say, yes, it does. But I kind of like it when the baddie gets away and you wonder, oh, are they going to come back next time? Mm. And I think if you do it well, it's brilliant because every book you're waiting to see if that person comes back again. Sometimes for me, when they wrap it up, they can wrap it up too neatly and, you know, it's a nice little package and you think, I wish there was a little bit more to that. So
it makes it a little bit less authentic, do you think?
I suppose it just depends on how well it's done. You know, if there's an epilogue and you've got a lot of information that kind of gives you that wrap up properly, then that's okay. It's when you kind of get to the end of the investigation and boom, that's it. Mm. You don't know what happens afterwards. Or did the person go to trial? Were they sentenced? When there's not that little bit more, I kind of feel like, oh, that's a bit of a lazy ending.
And you mentioned pace there. Just to clarify, are you saying that in a crime novel, you have to keep the pace quite intense and quite fast?
No, I think it kind of goes up and down. You know, you'll have lulls. So the first, if I'm not hooked by the first two chapters, then I kind of think, I think, you know, you've got to get the readers hooked in those first two chapters. And then it can kind of go up and down where something goes really intense and then you have that moment to breathe, but then you're back up again. It doesn't have to be a constant. I think thrillers maybe are quite action-packed in that sense. But for crime fiction, I think you kind of need that little bit of a lull throughout.
And space to think about, to kind of analyze a little bit what's going on.
Exactly. Because for me anyways, I love kind of running the investigation with the characters in the book. I like trying to solve it as well. So I like that little bit of thinking time to think, oh, was it him? What did they say about that? So yeah.
I'd like to know who did it up front.
I don't mind that either. I know some people don't particularly enjoy that kind of thing. I like when you kind of get the killer's point of view throughout the whole story and you know who the killer is. That's fine because you can then, it's almost like you know a secret that the main character doesn't know. And you're kind of like, no, don't go through there. He's over there.
He's behind you.
Exactly. It can also be quite exciting as well, but only if it's done well. So
tell us more about the book you're currently working on.
I can't tell you much about it because it hasn't been submitted yet. I have a title and I have a blurb, but I can't tell you what it is yet because it hasn't been announced. But it is a kind of, the way the first book ended, you know that my main character, DC Maggie Jameson, has been involved in another case that's kind of, she thought was behind her, but ends up coming back to life again. And she's convinced that this fella who's currently in prison is involved in some crimes that are happening at the moment. So she kind of needs to work with her team to make sure he stays inside while also looking after chasing the other person.
Right. Okay. Sounds intriguing.
I wish I could say more.
Could we talk a little bit about periphery characters? You've mentioned Maggie Jameson. Does she have a sidekick or a partner, or does she operate completely alone? Does she have an enemy within her police force, or, you know? I'm just interested to know about how you create that cast of characters around your central character.
Well, originally the book was supposed to be kind of different, and it kind of is still. It wasn't a police procedural, but they've changed it and suggested that I focus more on the police side. So obviously DC Maggie Jameson was the main police officer, so I kind of brought her to the forefront. But she works in this multi-agency environment, so she's working with probation, she's working with social care, she works with drug and alcohol units. So she's a criminal profiler. So she's got her hand in a lot of different agencies, which she kind of brings into a lot of her investigations. So the first book is Lucy's story as a probation officer with Maggie investigating these crimes where domestic abusers are being murdered. But the second book, Maggie's back with her main team, and she pulls in the offender profiler. So she's got a little bit of conflict with her DI, who is another kind of strong female character who has her moments of kind of insecurity, so takes them out on the rest of the team. So there's a bit of conflict there. And Maggie's also in this book, the second book, in a bit of conflict with her partner, DC Nathan Wright, who has just been newly promoted to DS, a role that Maggie herself had considered going for. So there's a little bit of conflict there because she's worried that, you know, he's going to try and pull rank to prove himself. And she doesn't know whether to trust him when she's thinking outside of the box on what she needs to do to solve this crime. Does she go to him? Doesn't she? So there's a little bit of conflict there as well.
I can see that that would add a lot of richness, a lot of layers, that kind of, you know, those relationships. I can see that certainly adding to the story and giving it more than, you know, one dimension. That sounds fascinating. And did people present themselves to you, you know, fully formed, or did you kind of have her, you know, did they appear? Did you have them in your mind when you started, or did they just tap you on the shoulder and say, give me a part?
Well, Lucy was definitely in my mind because the first book was really her story. So that was always in my mind. And Maggie wasn't someone I really thought about because the first book wasn't supposed to be a police procedural, but then all of a sudden she came to life. So it was great because I'm kind of learning about her and a lot of her quirks as I go along. Mm. And I'm still learning about her. So I love that.
I love that too.
And with the second police team, because she was working in it with another police team in the first book, they were all new to me as well. So some of them, the DI was familiar because she was name dropped in the first book, but Nathan Wright was totally new to me. And I was thinking, is he married? Does he have a family? What's he like? You know, all these things. And they do kind of crawl up to you and you're thinking, what the heck is happening here? And even as I was writing the book, things had changed. You know, I had an idea in my head about certain aspects of the story, but then, like you say, someone else tapped me on the shoulder and went, no, that's for me. I want to do that. And I was like, oh, okay.
You haven't given me any lines in this scene.
Exactly. So, and I used to laugh when I heard authors say, oh, you know, the voices in your head.
Oh, so but did it, I. So did I. I didn't really laugh even. I used to think, oh, don't be so pretentious. You're the writer. Yeah. Of course you know what they're going to say, but no.
Yeah.
When they're taking over from you and writing their own parts, I think that's when you know you're really immersed in something. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's wonderful. It is wonderful.
Tell us about your blog, Crime Book Junkie.
Crime Book Junkie, I started that up in May 2015. I was reading a lot of books and I didn't really understand the importance of Amazon reviews or anything like that. And I was in a few book groups where I saw bloggers and I was like, ooh, what the heck is a blogger? So I started guest reviewing on a friend's blog. She's now a friend. She approached me and I started guest reviewing on her blog. And eventually she was like, oh, just go and start up your own. So I did. And I only review books that I love on it because for me, I just think it's important when you read something wonderful and you want to shout out about it, that's my place to do it. I know some bloggers will do any book and every book they've read, but usually for me, because I have so many review requests and stuff, if a book doesn't grip me, I just won't read it and review it. And I'll let the author know, you know, if I had managed to go through it and I didn't particularly like it, I would contact the author and ask them what they would want me to do, because I know how hard it is to write a book. And, you know, if they don't want me to review it on Amazon or Goodreads, I'm not going to. You know, for me, sharing, you know, the importance of, you know, someone's writing and how much they enjoyed it and how it made me feel, that's what the blog is about. And I also post about events I've attended, and now I'm incorporating my book stuff on it because I've got far too many Facebook groups and pages and everything. I just couldn't handle another blog for being an author. So I've just put it all together. It makes it easier.
Brilliant. That's been wonderful talking to you, Noelle Holton. Thanks ever so much for making time for us.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, everyone. That was great. Now we're going to hear what Teresa and Bambi Lynn are reading at the moment. So, Teresa, what's on your bedside table?
At the moment, I am reading Melmoth, which is the second novel from Sarah Perry, who also wrote The Essex Serpent. And this owes a lot to the Victorian novel Melmoth the Wanderer by Charles Maturin. But she just writes so brilliantly, and there are a number of narratives within this. So there's a character called Helen, who's in the present day, an English woman living in Prague, living a very frugal life, a very quiet, very nondescript life. And she has this slightly odd friendship with a couple called Karel and Thea. And there's a manuscript. There's a manuscript they find which talks about this mythical being, Melmoth. Mm-hmm. But in her book, Melmoth is a female character. So it's sort of connected with the Wandering Jew myth. But she writes very beautifully, very descriptive. There's a lot of history as well of the Sudeten Germans living in what's now the Czech Republic and what happened in Prague in the war. So there's a lot of backstory in it, in the manuscript. But I have a slight problem because it's supernatural. I'm not mad on supernatural things. And in The Essex Serpent, I hope I'm not giving too much away to say that there is a rational explanation of the mysteries in that. But the way that this is written, I don't see how there can be a rational explanation. But I finished part one and I just started reading part two, and suddenly one of the characters says, yay, there's no such thing as Melmoth. So I don't know where it's going, but it's very, very beautifully written, very interesting characters. And I need to know.
Mm. Good. Thank you very much. And Bambi Lynn, what are you reading at the moment?
Right. So one of my favorite authors is Gina Showalter. And she writes paranormal romance, contemporary paranormal romance, that are about these minor ancient gods who were the ones who opened Pandora's box. And their punishment was that all the demons that came out of Pandora's box had to be hosted in them. So each one of them has a demon from Pandora's box living in them. Lords of the Underworld is the series. I'm reading right now The Darkest Seduction, which is probably number 8 or 9 in the series. There are a whole lot of them in the series, but I highly recommend it. Gina Showalter, love her.
Thank you very much. Well, that's it for Write Club this week. Thank you for joining us once again. Subscribe to iTunes or Stitcher so that every new show is automatically delivered where you want it. Come along and join our Facebook group. Just search on Facebook for Write Club the podcast. Best of all, you could leave us a 5-star review wherever you're listening. And do tell a friend about Write Club. That'll help us grow. We'll be back again next week at the same time for another episode of Write Club the podcast. We hope you can join us. Thanks very much, everyone.
Bye. Bye.